Hello and welcome to another episode of Envisioneering Exchange, the podcast where industry leaders discuss the most important topics in sustainability, climate change, buildings, and urban efficiency. I'm Vic Marinich with Danfoss, and I'm delighted to be the host of this podcast. You can subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Captivate, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today, we have Danielle Wright, Executive Director of the North American Sustainable Refrigeration Council, or NASRC. And she's here to talk to us about the potential for natural refrigerants in the commercial refrigeration industry. Danielle, thanks for taking the time to join the show.
Thanks, Vic. Thanks for having me on. I'm always happy to talk about refrigerants.
Awesome, as are we. So maybe can you tell us a bit more about your background and how you came to work in the field of sustainable refrigeration, and maybe tell us a bit more about the NASRC?
Yeah, so I've always had an interest in the built environment, partly because of the large impact that it has on the environment and my desire to find solutions that are good for the environment and also for business. So there's a huge source of emissions in the built environment, but also a big potential for that positive impact. I started my career working on green building standards and moved towards the energy side and focused really on energy efficiency for the first decade. And I was always fascinated with grocery stores because they have this, you know, enormous energy use that's 24/7, right? Some of the highest EUI energy use intensities per square foot in the nation. And it's a big potential for a big business win. So every dollar saved on their energy bill is, tenfold going towards their bottom line. I managed a third-party program for a large utility in California that provided rebates for energy efficiency retrofits. And so that was mostly focused in the grocery space and refrigeration. And I came to the world of refrigerants through a workshop that was hosted by some of the co-founders of this organization. So it was right before the organization was formed. And attending that workshop just really opened my eyes to the environmental impact of refrigerants. And I was totally hooked.
NASRC, you're really helping play a significant role in encouraging the adoption of climate-friendly refrigerants. So what kind of initiatives do you have rolling right now?
Well, we started almost 10 years ago, and it was really an organization that was focused on overcoming the barriers to natural adoption. The founders of the organization that were some of the key players in the supermarket refrigeration space, they saw the potential for naturals to be the most future-proof, most climate-friendly, really the long-term business solution, but they also saw a lot of challenges. So the main strategy for the organization to overcome those challenges in the early days and has really been very successful, it was to bring every major stakeholder to the table so that they could work together in partnership to overcome those barriers. So that really does two important things. It brings every perspective to really understand the problem that we're trying to solve. And it also gets real leverage behind getting the work done. So we've been very successful in overcoming those initial market barriers that were, kind of preventing the adoption. And now we're really focused on accelerating adoption. So naturals have really taken off. And so we see our work, really focused in three core areas. We are focused on funding the replacement of existing equipment with natural refrigerant equipment. We're launching a $65 million program here in California, the FRIP, or the F Gas Reduction Incentive Program, in partnership with the California Air Resources Board, or really funded by the Air Resources Board, to replace existing HFC equipment with natural equipment. We hope to expand this model, this program, to other states. We work on informing the market, so we really look to see how we can leverage our extensive membership to produce resources, case studies, educational materials, technical guidance that can help inform and really align the market for naturals. And most critically, we're focused on workforce development. So, you can have all the money in the world to pay for projects, you can have the best technologies, but without the people to install the systems, service the systems, maintain the systems properly, we really aren't going to get to our goal.
You mentioned a few times that natural refrigerants and so on, and I think most people probably understand what we're talking about, but just to make sure, which specific refrigerants are you talking about and what makes those refrigerants natural?
Yeah, so we're talking about carbon dioxide, CO2, propane, and ammonia. And the term natural is really just referring to the fact that these are naturally occurring in the environment. Some of the first vapor compression systems, when refrigeration first came around, the 1850s used some of these refrigerants. I think a better term for them, you know, natural is kind of a funny term because it's not like we're taking CO2 out of the atmosphere yet and pumping it into a system. I think a better term is probably future-proof refrigerants. And that's also because these refrigerants don't deplete the ozone layer. They have the lowest global warming potential of any refrigerants. And they're not considered a PFAS, which is a new class of chemicals that are toxic and are causing widespread contamination. So the fact that these are absent of all those negative qualities is also what distinguishes them. One other thing I'll say about naturals is that you can't patent them. So that's another reason why our organization exists. You know, we're kind of the champion for these refrigerants that otherwise aren't really marketable in that way.
I guess I never thought about the patent part, but you're right. That makes is a real big game changer there too as well. And you're right. So no PFAS and zero GWP, zero ODP are very, very close. But I guess they still have their own challenges with these natural refrigerants. And so the transition to these natural refrigerants is going to require significant shift, I think, in the commercial refrigeration industry. What do you see as those biggest challenges and the trends that the industry is fighting with right now?
We're really at an inflection point here with the adoption of naturals, or I should say the transition away from HFCs really taking off. And the two major forces that are really behind accelerating this rapid transition away from HFCs, you know, number one is regulations, the federal and state level. But number two, and becoming equally as important of a driver, are corporate climate targets that many publicly held and privately held companies have now and need to show progress towards in order to show that they're a viable business going forward in the future, right? And so those internal corporate climate targets for a grocery store, if you look at their scope one emissions, over half of that is going to come from the refrigerants. So there's no way for them to meet those targets without doing something about the existing HFCs and moving away from those HFCs. And naturals are a really great alternative for all the reasons that we talked about. Really, the biggest challenge here is how they're going to replace that existing equipment with natural refrigerant-based equipment because it's not a drop-in solution.
Right. And I think there's each one of those, the natural refrigerants you mentioned, have their own challenges, right? I mean, if it's CO2, we have pressures we have to worry about. If it's ammonia, then anybody who's been near an ammonia plant knows the smell and everything we get to deal with. And of course, R290 is highly flammable. So we've seen from HCFCs to HFCs, and that took some time, but was fairly easy, I think, in comparison to this next step, because we really do have to make a step change in the technology too somehow, whether it's around safety, around pressures, or what have you. And you mentioned regulations are playing a role. I mean, how do you see it? Is it mostly carrot, mostly stick? What is it, do you think, right now that's going to help the market the most to make those changes needed?
Yeah, you make a good point about the sort of unattractive qualities of CO2, propane, and ammonia. I will say, you know, on the refrigeration side, we're lucky because we have in place the appropriate codes and standards and safety protocols to really mitigate those risks. There are challenges on the HVAC side that we might talk about, but really on commercial refrigeration, we've taken care of those problems. And regulations, you know, I would say that there's several layers now. It's really like a matrix of regulations to deal with. We've got, you know, federal and state regulations on one side, and then we have regulations that pertain to the global warming potential or greenhouse gas emissions. And then we've got emerging, you know, PFAS regulations coming up as well at the federal and state level. So the biggest driver at the federal level is going to be the AIM Act, which is phasing down the production and consumption primarily of HFC refrigerants on the basis of their global warming potential or carbon equivalent emissions. And this was signed into law in 2020. It mirrors one of the most successful international agreements, the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol, and it gives the EPA the authority under three main areas. You've got the production consumption phase down, which is really getting at the supply of HFCs. And then you've got the technology transition, which sets limits for GWP based on certain end uses that's addressing demand. And then you've got the refrigerant management authority, which is, again, addressing the demand side. States are taking it one step further in some cases. We've got California, New York, Washington, that are all, you know, looking, they're on track to supersede what the AIM Act baseline now, the federal baseline. And that's really being driven by their state climate targets that they've identified, that refrigerants is the biggest bang for their buck, you know, biggest impact, lowest cost way to get to those climate targets. So that makes for a complicated environment to navigate for any end user.
Yeah, and then you throw, who's it, Maine and Minnesota in for the PFAS regulations that they're kicking off. And yeah, it gets pretty complicated. It was interesting too, I was thinking, you said how refrigeration, you know, we've kind of solved most of the challenges. You know, if I think, right, R290, small charges, small equipment, right, vending machines and display case and that stuff, medium-sized stuff, refrigeration racks and supermarkets, CO2, and the big industrial refrigeration stuff is ammonia. You know, and you think, at least an old guy like me remembers way back in the day, like that was all R22 30 years ago, right? But because we've got to be so focused, because of the challenges with all the different refrigerants bring, I think the days of the one-size-fits-all solutions are long gone. You're not going to see big industrial facilities, probably, or at least not refrigeration with, you know, propane, for example, and stuff. So, and the legislation to drive then all these very specific applications, again, for when we talk refrigeration, supermarkets are, I guess, the big culprits, right, where we worry the most about leaks. But, you know, if we talk everything from a little vending machine up through massive cold storage warehouses, I mean, we're going to need a lot of different solutions. And then all the legislation has to match all these different applications, all these different products. It's a, you said it's going to be a really complicated matrix going forward, right?
Yeah. I mean, we like to say, you know, if it was easy, then we wouldn't need to exist, right? So that's what we're here to help navigate and really try to address some of those biggest barriers.
And I do think in general, private public partnerships are working a lot better these days. You know, 20, 30 years ago, it was maybe a bit more adversarial, you know, but now I really think everybody's kind of on the same page pushing in the same direction. So although maybe certain stakeholders want things to go faster or slower, I do think everybody's kind of on the same page. And I would say, right, we have the same address in our GPS, right? Maybe we just have a little bit different ways that we think we want to get there. So I think that's helpful also. At least from the conversations I've seen, I've been having, it's not so much a contentious fight anymore, right?
No, I mean, we're seeing that, yeah, alignment in a lot of areas. And one of the things we do best at NASRC and one of the reasons we've been successful is through collaboration. It's really encouraging to see competitors coming together on the retailer side. We have a monthly roundtable call with our end users and they're exchanging information, they're aligning, they're looking for those opportunities to leverage their collective power to go farther faster.
So it seems maybe we're just at the base of that hockey stick, right? But if you look at where Europe is and maybe where Canada is, I think they're a lot further down this path than we are here in the U.S. So what do you see as those barriers to adoption? And what do you think we need to do to address them to really start climbing up the hockey stick there?
The main barrier that we're seeing is around the workforce and the need for trained, you know, qualified technicians to install, service, and maintain all of these system types. That's not a short-term problem. It's not an overnight fix. It's something we really have to build up to. You know, the industry, the workforce has been having issues for many years now. There's been a lot of more people leaving the industry than coming into it, kind of this negative reinforcing cycle of technician burnout. The technician burnout loop is what we call it. And it's just not a sustainable work-life balance. We really see this is the thing that's going to make the difference in that hockey stick and help us ensure a really smooth transition.
Yeah, the days of having, you know, a wrench and a torch and being able to fix everything, I think, are gone, because when we talk about either more flammability, more toxicity, more pressure, we need to have more safeties. And these days, everything's electronic to manage it, to make sure all those systems are super safe. So if you don't have a good, well-trained workforce, that can lead to a lot of problems down the road, right? And so not such a simple challenge, absolutely. Yeah. So we've talked a lot about on the refrigeration side, maybe just a quick question on HVAC. How do you see things moving on the HVAC side of the industry? Do you see natural refrigerants developing in there? How are they moving along? What do you think will be happening in the commercial building space?
And like I said before, on the commercial refrigeration food retail side, we have these technologies that are widely available. We have the codes and standards in place to ensure that they are feasible to adopt. I think the main difference on the HVAC side is that the products aren't available here yet in the US market. We can see plenty of examples where there's CO2 heat pumps, propane heat pumps, all kinds of systems available globally. So really the hurdle here is the codes and standards that are effectively blocking those products from coming to market. And in some cases, you know, just have to be developed because they don't exist yet.
Yeah. I was in some meetings recently with DOE, and we were talking about the transition from 410A to the next HFCs, the A2Ls, was a 14-year transition. And it was all, or mostly, a lot of codes and regulations and those kinds of things that had to do. So if we want to take that next step, I think we all agreed it's going to need to have to happen faster. But I think for air conditioning, there also has to be a lot of technology changes. We're a airside industry here in the U.S., right? I mean, there's 400,000 rooftop units, 10 million residential units going out, and it's all airside. Where Europe, on those propane heat pumps, it's water to water. So the only thing going in your house is water, not the potential for flammable gas. So it's going to take a significant shift. And I think the industry sees that and understands that. And where do you take that first bite of the elephant, I think, is kind of what we've been discussing in these meetings. What kind of technologies need to come to place? The legislation can go in parallel, but how do you get that house today that has a 3-ton ducted split outside into something that's probably an A3, right, if it's propane, and it can't be designed or installed the way it is today? So I think there's a lot of challenges on the HVAC side, but recent discussions, I think, are showing that there's a consensus that we need to at least find what that path forward is and what the hurdles are to the legislation. Because, as you said, a lot of them are in place today for supermarkets, for refrigeration, but wouldn't at all apply to the way we put air conditioning systems in. So there's going to be a lot of work on the HVAC side too to come, I think, technical and on the legislative side.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also a big potential, big opportunity.
Yeah, I haven't done the math, but you have to imagine 10 million residential units. I don't know, 5 pounds charge each. That's a lot of refrigerant that's out there, right?
Exactly. Big market.
So if we jump back to the training, and I guess it can cover both HVAC and refrigeration, what kind of training are you thinking that we need to get those contractors ready for this transition to naturals?
Our approach is really to try and be as comprehensive as possible. So it starts with training. And where we've started is really, you know, training the existing technicians, getting the fundamentals, getting them comfortable, kind of demystifying CO2 and propane has really been our focus here. We do these through a series of events we call our training summits, where we bring together expert trainers from around the country representing different technologies, different OEMs and manufacturers, and bring them all together in a 3-day training format, kind of a choose your own adventure. There's over 20 different classes to choose from, and they repeat throughout the 2-3-day period. There's classroom classes, also hands-on classes. We also have a comprehensive and agnostic program that is developed by our training director, Rusty Walker, who goes in and provides training on a, depending on the need, can customize that training program over a 2- or 3-day period. From there, you know, our approach is then we want to work backwards. And so from training, we think, well, how can we get schools sunk up with this training program? How can we ensure that the graduates from the HVAC and our school programs are ready to work in this field? And they may not be as advanced or experienced as the technicians that we're training, but we want them to get some exposure to CO2 and propane before they get to the workforce. And that actually really starts with training the faculty members at those programs. So training the trainers, at the schools, because if they're not comfortable with CO2 or propane or even refrigeration, you know, you may get a guy who's really, his background is in HVAC. Well, he's not going to be able to train his students on refrigeration, or he's not going to want to focus in that area if he can't get the training himself. From there, we focus on how can we get more students into those programs. You know, once we build up the programs, they have strong refrigeration, strong focus on CO2 and propane. How can we recruit more people into those programs? And then even beyond that, pre-recruiting, how do we get high schoolers, middle schoolers exposed to this as a trade so that they're even thinking about going into these programs? There's very few programs today that even give those students a chance to get their hands on equipment and see that this is something that actually they might have a technical aptitude for. So to that end, you know, we're launching a new platform this year that's going to focus on a, you know, comprehensive workforce development all the way from pre-recruiting, getting those middle schoolers interested or even earlier, all the way through training and retaining our existing technicians. So this will house all of those new resources and initiatives. And, you know, it's going to highlight naturals, but it also has to be comprehensive. Good natural refrigerant technicians start as good technicians, period. And the reality today is that 99% of what's still out there isn't natural based. This will definitely have a focus on those natural refrigerants, but it will also be comprehensive enough to really focus on refrigeration workforce development.
Right. Yeah, there's going to be a long, long time when we still have HFCs. I mean, I know neighbors who still have R22 units outside their home, right? I mean, this stuff is going to be around a long time. It's funny because I have several friends who are HVAC contractors and they love what they do. You know, you talk to them and okay, being on a roof on a 110 degree day or a minus 20 degree day, maybe is not so fantastic, but every day is different. They really love what they do. They love the fact that it's a combination of skills, right? You have to understand the electrical part. You have to understand the thermodynamic part, the mechanical part. I mean, it's super challenging. And I guess we're just having a hard time conveying the message to the right people, because everybody I know, once they're in the industry, I think love it. So yeah, good luck with the pre-seeding with the high school and middle school kids, because I think that can really be super interesting for them going forward.
Yeah, there was a survey we did when we first kicked this off in 2022. We wanted to better understand the issues, why there was these gaps, you know, what were some of the drivers, and gather some data so that we could make sure to focus on the right solutions. And this term that came up over and over again, we coined, you know, the joy of problem solving, because it was something that almost every technician said that they loved about their job in one way, shape, or form, was just what you said. Yeah, it's a new challenge every day. I love the feeling when I figure it out. There's nothing like walking out of a store once you've brought the rack back online and you're the hero. And so, yeah, it's something definitely that's worth highlighting and that most people don't get in their everyday jobs. Something that we're focused on and that we, as part of this workforce development platform, we're going to have the first ever really refrigeration focused career campaign. And just like you said, you know, how can we make more people aware of this? It's really an unseen but essential job that doesn't get the credit it deserves and doesn't get the spotlight.
And these days, certainly almost a job guarantee if you're good at what you're doing, because we really need them out there, you know?
It's pandemic proof.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So now we've got everybody trained and we're on our way to an all natural refrigeration market. How do you see that commercial refrigeration industry 5 years from now? What is it going to look like, do you think?
We have the same question, and we put that question out to our retailer members a year ago and did a survey. And the results that came back, or the responses that came back, represented over 18,000 food retail locations in the U.S. We asked about the adoption of CO2 specifically in new and existing stores over the next 5 years. And the results showed, you know, huge growth, so over 300% growth in adoption over the next 5 years. And one of the really interesting things we saw was that that growth was mostly coming from the replacement of existing systems. So yes, there was some new systems coming online, but really the majority of the growth came from replacing HFC with either, you know, CO2 transcritical or secondary systems. The other interesting thing that came out of it is over half of the stores represented, they're aiming for about 40% of their total portfolio to be converted to CO2. So that's huge. And that's a huge feat to try and accomplish in 5 years' time. So it's a very ambitious target. And again, it goes back to those corporate climate targets that we were talking about and wanting to stay ahead of regulations. One of the significant things we got out of that is for that to take place, that's more CO2 systems that exist in North America today, more than are manufactured today. So really, it was a signal to manufacturers to need to ramp up their supply in order to meet this need. To me, it translates into a major opportunity for growth. And there's the willingness. We've got some of the funding behind it. We've got ways to optimize the technology, build up the workforce over that time. So I hope, you know, in 5 years' time, we realize that vision. We see that 300% growth, and it's as smooth as possible.
So you mentioned what 40% of the stores want to be CO2 in the next 5 years. Is that a normal remodel cycle for those stores, or do you think are they reducing the remodel time to get CO2 in there faster?
They're ramping it up big time. So the normal remodel cycle is around, you know, 3 to 5% of a store portfolio per year. So we'd be looking at 20-25% over 5 years, and they're going for that 40%, so almost double.
Okay. And I guess some of the carrots from the AIM Act and so on are helping drive that the incremental increase on the remodels, right?
I wouldn't say that there's too many carrots at this point with the AIM Act. It's more of a stick. Certainly there's funding programs that can help, you know, the one we're launching in California. I think, you know, again, a lot of this has to do with those internal corporate climate targets and being able to show that you have a viable business, meaning that those scope one emissions that are coming from your refrigerants, you know, are being taken care of or being addressed.
Before we wrap up, Danielle, is there anything else you want to make sure the listeners know, something that we didn't cover?
Just that we have a number of free resources available online. A lot of the training resources that are being housed currently on our website, you can find at www.nasrc.org. And, you know, reach out to us if you're inspired by any of this or want to get involved.
Great. Thanks for joining us, Danielle.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode of Envisioneering Exchange. I'd like to thank my guest, Danielle Wright from NASRC, for joining us. Don't forget to subscribe to Envisioneering Exchange on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Captivate, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Lastly, if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate, review, and share it with your network. Thanks for listening, and talk to you next time.
This podcast is for information purposes only. The views, information, or opinions expressed during the Envisioneering Exchange podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and not necessarily represent those of Danfoss LLC and its employees. Danfoss LLC is not responsible and does not verify for accuracy any of the information contained in the podcast series available for listening on this site. This podcast series does not constitute professional advice or services. This podcast, including Danfoss LLC and the producers, disclaim responsibility from any possible adverse effects of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and Danfoss LLC in this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility of statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about the guest qualifications or credibility. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. You may not edit, modify, or redistribute this podcast. The developers of the Envisioneering Exchange podcast site assume no liability for any activities in connection with this podcast or for use of this podcast in connection with any other website, computer, or playing device.